Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Mindfulness Solution, Everyday Practices for Everyday Problems, by Ronald D. Siegel, PsyD. Narrated by Paul Bryan. Preface. When I first took up mindfulness practice in college, I was impressed. Learning to attend to and accept the present moment, to really stop and smell the roses, had immediate benefits. Worries about getting good grades, finding a girlfriend, and being cool began falling away. Boredom practically disappeared. I imagined that after a few years of practice, I'd be free of hurt, pain, and worry, blissfully enjoying the rest of my life. I'm sorry to report that things didn't quite turn out that way. I soon learned that mindfulness practice isn't a very good narcotic. It doesn't really make pain disappear. But don't put this book away yet. Mindfulness practice actually offers something even more valuable. Instead of anesthetizing us, it helps us see more clearly the habits of our minds that create unnecessary suffering and offers a way to change them. In my own practice, it didn't take long to see how my mind was constantly drawn to fantasize about the next party and dread the next research paper, rarely appreciating the moment. I also noticed how thoughts about being smart or dumb, attractive or ugly, good or bad, a success or failure, were my constant companion, coloring my moods and keeping me stressed. I realized, too, that despite my continued efforts, the highs that came from getting a good grade, making out with a new flame, or winning a tennis match never lasted very long. I soon found myself chasing the next victory or comfort. Luckily, along with showing me how these mental habits were making me unhappy, mindfulness practice offered an alternative, a way to live my life with more ease, less concerned with chasing after highs and trying to avoid lows. I could use the practice to notice the trees as I walked to class, taste my food in the dining hall, and connect more intimately with my friends. I could watch thoughts and feelings come and go without getting so caught up in them. Paying attention to the present moment in this way began to transform my relationship to life's ups and downs. Even difficult moments, like when my girlfriend moved away to be with the other guy, felt more manageable as I learned how to attend to rather than escape from my anger, sadness, and vulnerability. As my own college-age children are fond of pointing out, nearly 40 years into this, on the surface, I still don't look like a poster child for mindfulness practice. In the car running late for an appointment, I often get tense and start to use what my kids affectionately call that voice. And when they say, "Dad, don't you teach people how to live in the moment? Doesn't mindfulness practice help you accept the things you can't change?" I don't always appreciate their wisdom. Now that my daughters are old enough to understand the scientific method, I'm able to point out that we don't have a good control group. We don't know with certainty how distressed I'd be by everyday problems without mindfulness practice. And I'm convinced from both my own experience and from research findings that the answer is a lot more distressed. In my early days of practice, I hoped that it would give me a whole new personality. I've discovered that instead, mindfulness practice has actually helped me enjoy the one I have while giving me effective tools to work with life's inevitable challenges. Tools without which, I'm afraid, I'd really be in bad shape. Mindfulness practice has not only been enormously useful for me personally, but is proving to be helpful for a remarkable number of people dealing with an equally remarkable range of everyday problems. Research is showing that it can help us work effectively not only with worry about being late for appointments and other anxieties, but also with sadness and depression, stress-related medical conditions such as insomnia, digestive difficulties, sexual problems, and chronic pain, and addictions to everything from alcohol and drugs to food, gambling, and shopping. It can help us get along better with our children, parents, friends, coworkers, and romantic partners. It can even help us age more gracefully and find happiness that doesn't depend on fickle fortunes. How can one practice possibly help with so many different problems? The answer is that they're all made worse by the same natural tendency. In our effort to feel good, we try to avoid or escape discomfort, only to discover that this in fact multiplies our misery. An astonishing variety of problems actually stem from our attempts to get rid of problems. By helping us with our moment-to-moment experience in a new way, mindfulness offers us a surprising solution. Many of us are so busy that the thought of adding one more thing, no matter how potentially beneficial, is just too much. The good news is that mindfulness practice can be taken up in different ways to suit different lifestyles. While making time for formal meditation is important, mindfulness can also be practiced as part of our ordinary routine. While brushing our teeth, driving to work, walking the dog, or waiting in the checkout line. Most people actually feel as though they have more time in their lives once they begin practicing mindfulness. They become increasingly focused and efficient while feeling more rested and less stressed. There are even specific mindfulness practices we can use during crises when we're about to lose it, when we are so aggravated, upset, or overwhelmed that we're at risk of saying or doing something we will regret. These practices make life easier by helping us create fewer messes that we need to clean up later. My own journey with mindfulness practice has continued unbroken from my college years through my training and career as a clinical psychologist. It provided the backdrop for my study of psychology. Early in my training, few mental health professionals were interested in mindfulness practice. I was fortunate in the early 1980s to join a group of like-minded clinicians who were all practicing personally. For many years, we met regularly and discussed what mindfulness traditions had to offer conventional psychology and what conventional psychology had to offer mindfulness traditions. We didn't speak much about this in the wider professional community since meditation and related practices weren't highly valued in those days. Nobody wanted to be accused of having unresolved infantile longings to return to a state of oceanic oneness, what Freud saw as the unconscious motivation behind meditation. In the late 1990s, things began to change. My colleagues and I began presenting in workshops some of what we had been discussing privately. Gradually, larger and larger numbers of mental health providers took interest. The pace soon accelerated, and practically overnight, mindfulness practice became one of the most researched and discussed treatment approaches in the mental health field. Suddenly, my colleagues and I were being invited to write and teach everywhere about how these practices could be used both inside and outside of psychotherapy to resolve all sorts of emotional and behavioral difficulties. All over the world, mindfulness-based treatments were being developed and tested for every imaginable problem, and they were proving to be remarkably effective. While relatively new to us in the West, Asian cultures have been refining mindfulness practices for thousands of years. These ancient teachings have informed my colleagues and my work throughout our careers. This book, therefore, includes the fruits of many people's efforts. It includes wisdom passed down from the traditions that originally developed mindfulness practices, insights developed by my colleagues who have been exploring mindfulness and psychotherapy together for several decades, and recent innovations by researchers and clinicians who have been developing mindfulness-based approaches to working with a wide range of psychological conditions. It also includes lessons I've learned both personally and from my patients who have used mindfulness practices to work with common and not so common difficulties. Part 1. Why Mindfulness Matters. Chapter 1. Life is difficult for everyone. Do you ever wonder, why is my life so difficult? I wonder about this a lot. Compared to the vast majority of the 6 billion people on the planet, I've had it pretty easy. Good parents, no really serious diseases so far, plenty of food and shelter, a loving wife and children, caring friends, even an interesting career. Still, not a day goes by without my mind generating some sort of subtle or not so subtle emotional suffering. Am I starting to get a cold? I really don't want to be sick over the weekend. I hope my daughter does well on today's test. She was so upset after the last one. I wish this traffic would clear up. I can't be late again. If only I had... Getting old really sucks. Who knew? Why does my mind fill with thoughts like these all day long? Do I just have bad genes? Perhaps, but if so, I seem to have plenty of company. Emotional suffering comes in all shapes and sizes. We might worry about the future, be angry or sad, feel guilty or ashamed, get upset about physical pain, or just feel bored or stressed. Sometimes it's pretty subtle. We don't feel great or are out of sorts. Other times we can get so taken over by anxiety, depression, addictions, pain, or stress-related symptoms that it's hard to even function. A remarkable amount of the time, being human isn't easy. Happiness is possible, but optional. The problem may be that we did not evolve to be happy. Natural selection, the process that guides evolution, favors adaptations that help us reproduce successfully. This means surviving long enough to mate, snag a partner, and then support our children's survival. Evolutionary forces don't particularly care whether we enjoy our life, unless this increases our survival or mating potential. And they don't really care about what happens to us after our childbearing and protecting years are over. But we care. While most of us think the survival of humanity is a good idea, we would also like to be able to enjoy our lives while we're here. It doesn't seem like a lot to ask. Yet, we struggle. As a clinical psychologist, I've had a window into the lives of many other people, and they all find life to be difficult. Of course, my patients might be an unusual lot. After all, aren't people with problems the ones that seek psychotherapy? While there is some truth to this, I suspect that most of them are actually in no more distress than people who are not in therapy. They're just more motivated and able to do something about it. On top of this, every friend, colleague, and family member that I've ever known well, whether or not they've been in therapy, seems to find life emotionally challenging too. What's wrong with us? Life is so remarkable. The natural world and human culture are astonishingly complex and interesting, and by historical standards, almost everyone in developed countries live privileged lives full of riches. Most of us never experience the tragedies that we see on the news, like losing a family in a natural disaster, being attacked by a hostile army, or barely surviving a horrible accident. And yet, we all experience a surprising amount of stress and emotional pain. Have we actually evolved to be unhappy? In a sense, yes. What counts in natural selection is the survival of the species. Certain instincts and intellectual abilities that have helped our species prosper over the past few million years have created some pretty negative consequences for us as individuals. Let's consider an example from the past. Fred and Wilma were early Homo sapiens living on the plains of East Africa about 40,000 years ago. They had evolved quite a bit from their Homo erectus ancestors, developing enormous brains. In fact, they each needed to eat 400 calories a day, a fifth of their normal diet, just to keep these going. The couple used their brains to do all sorts of marvelous things that helped them survive. To think abstractly, plan for their future, find novel solutions to problems, and trade with their neighbors. They were even able to make cave paintings and stone jewelry in their spare time. But all was not well on the savannah. Fred's and Wilma's brains also gave them trouble. They worried about rhinoceroses and lions, were envious of their neighbors who had a bigger cave, and got into arguments over who should haul the water on hot days. When it was cold and rainy, they both got irritable, remembering how much better they liked the sun. They noticed changes around them, fretting when there wasn't as much fruit on the trees, roots to eat, or insect larvae, a favorite treat to snack on. When neighbors got sick or died, they were distressed to realize that this could happen to them too. Sometimes Wilma got upset when Fred looked at other women. Then she wouldn't have sex with him, which upset him. Sometimes they both thought about their dog that was eaten by the hyenas, and they felt terrible whenever their son was hurt by the bully from over the hill. Even when everything was going well, they had thoughts about what had gone wrong in the past or what might befall them in the future. Fred and Wilma were surviving pretty well, and their son had a good chance of making it too, but they still had a lot on their minds. In some regards, things haven't changed much over the last 40,000 years. Our brains, marvelous as they are, continue to give us trouble. Fortunately, though, some of the same abilities that helped our ancestors survive have also enabled us to develop effective practices to deal with our troublesome brains and enhance our happiness. Luckily, these techniques have come a long way since Fred and Wilma's time. Mindfulness, an antidote. Mindfulness is one of these practices. It developed through thousands of years of cultural evolution as an antidote to the natural habits of our hearts and minds that make life much more difficult than it needs to be. Mindfulness is a particular attitude toward experience or way of relating to life that holds the promise of both alleviating our suffering and making our lives rich and meaningful. It does this by attuning us to our moment-to-moment experience and giving us direct insight into how our minds create unnecessary anguish. When our minds topple forward into worries about being attacked or running out of food, mindfulness practice helps bring us back to the relative safety of the present moment. When our minds make envious or competitive comparisons with our neighbor's husband, wife, or home, mindfulness practice helps us see that these are just symbols and no lasting victory is possible. When our minds protest against the heat or cold, mindfulness helps us notice that it is actually the protesting, not the temperature itself, that causes our suffering. Even when illness or death visits us or our loved ones, mindfulness helps us understand and accept the natural order. By helping us observe exactly how we create our own distress, mindfulness practices teach us how to let go of painful mental habits and replace them with more useful ones. Various cultures have developed their own ways to cultivate mindfulness, each shaped by particular philosophic or religious views. Despite differences in approach, all of these practices evolved to deal with psychological difficulties similar to those we face today. In the East, mindfulness developed in Hindu, Buddhist, Taoist, and other traditions as a component of yoga and meditation practices, designed to free the mind of unwholesome habits. In the West, mindfulness is an element in many Jewish, Christian, Muslim, and Native American practices designed for spiritual growth. Secular artists, athletes, writers, and others have also developed techniques involving mindfulness to clear the mind and facilitate their work. While some of these practices take exotic forms, others are very simple and practical. Over the past decade or so, researchers and mental health professionals have been discovering that both ancient and modern mindfulness practices hold great promise for ameliorating virtually every kind of psychological suffering, from everyday worry, dissatisfaction, and neurotic habits, to more serious problems with anxiety, depression, substance abuse, and related conditions. They're even proving useful for enhancing romantic, parenting, and other interpersonal relationships, and for fostering overall happiness. Research and clinical practice are beginning to demonstrate what ancient cultures have long proclaimed, that mindfulness provides insight into what causes our distress and offers effective ways to alleviate it. Lucky for us, it is a skill that can be learned by almost everyone. Fortunately, too, there are ways to cultivate mindfulness without huge new time commitments. You can actually learn to develop mindfulness while engaged in normal everyday activities such as walking, driving, showering, and doing dishes. But if you can also set aside regular times for formal mindfulness practice, you may end up actually feeling less pressured and better able to deal with obligations as your mind becomes clearer and your body becomes less stressed. This book will show you how to cultivate mindfulness in the midst of your daily routines, as well as how to develop it through a step-by-step program of formal practices. Either way, learning mindfulness will help you enrich good times and work more effectively with the bad ones. To understand how mindfulness can be so worthwhile, you need to understand a bit more about why life as we normally live it can be so hard. Let's start with the obvious. Our prognosis is terrible. In the workshops on mindfulness and psychotherapy that I conduct for mental health professionals, I sometimes ask the audience, "Who here is going to die?" No more than half the hands ever go up. Everything changes, and everything that is born dies. We know this, yet we don't like to think about it. A great Zen master renowned for his wisdom was once asked, "What's the most remarkable thing you've learned in all of your years of meditation and study?" He answered, "The most remarkable thing is that we're all going to die, but we live each day as though it weren't so." He was on to something important. In fact, we can understand much of our emotional suffering by looking at how we react when things change. "I don't want to give up my pacifier. I don't want to use the potty. I like my diapers." I don't want to go to school. Our resistance to change starts very early in life and continues with every subsequent transition: moving, losing friends and loved ones, changing life roles. Who really wants to grow up and drive a minivan? I cried when my twin daughters went off to college. After all that effort and so many intimate moments together, why did they have to leave home? My wife wisely pointed out that the alternative, not being emotionally or intellectually able to go off to college, might be even more upsetting. Looking forward, something tells me I won't be too thrilled when it's time to enter an assisted living facility or say goodbye to this world entirely. Resisting these inevitable changes causes us considerable unhappiness. Judith Viorst wrote a groundbreaking book that many psychotherapists read in the 1980s called Necessary Losses, which points out that most of what makes us unhappy involves difficulty dealing with the inevitability of change. This certainly fits my experience, both personally and professionally. Could it be true for you too? A resistance to change inventory. Take a moment to make two short lists. First, list a few of the more emotionally difficult changes that have happened over the course of your life, the ones that you really didn't welcome. Second, list the most recent few changes, no matter how small, that you found yourself resisting. Now, next to each item, jot down what emotions the change brought up at the time. You may have noticed that your life has been full of unwelcome changes, both big and small. Do the changes that came to mind have anything in common? Did similar emotions arise in response to each of them? Since we all find some changes easier than others, the answer to these questions may hold clues as to which you find most challenging and which feelings arise most often. These clues will help you later choose the mindfulness practices that are most suited to your needs. Hooked on pleasure. Have you ever wondered why donuts are so irresistible? Nutritionalists speculate that we are attracted to donuts, despite their deadly biological effects, because sweet and fatty tastes were associated with getting nutrients when food was both natural and scarce. It's no surprise that we are hardwired to enjoy those things that historically have helped us survive and reproduce. For the same reason that our cars just seem to steer themselves to the donut shop, we are fond of love, sex, and comfortable temperatures. And we typically do what we can to avoid pain and discomfort. These sensations, after all, are generally associated with harm to the body. Putting a hand too close to a fire, being bitten by a saber-toothed tiger, and freezing in the snow are all both unpleasant and dangerous. The problem is that our wonderfully adaptive tendency to seek pleasure and avoid pain, while great for our collective survival, locks us into shopping for pleasure and running from pain all day long. The species thrives, but as individuals, we live each day perpetually stressed. So on top of the inevitability of change and loss, we have here another built-in source of emotional pain. Both ancient philosophers and modern psychologists have pondered our tendency to seek pleasure. Freud described it as the pleasure principle, and pointed out that it explains a lot of our behavior. Later, behavioral psychologists observe that we continue to repeat those actions that are followed by rewards, which are generally experienced as pleasurable. These forces play a role in everything we do. Our whole economy revolves around producing and selling goods and services designed to bring us pleasure. Unfortunately, the pleasure principle also makes it difficult for us to just be. In virtually every moment, we're attempting to adjust our experience, trying to hold on to pleasant moments and avoid unpleasant ones. This makes it very difficult to relax fully and feel at ease or satisfied. We become like Goldilocks, reacting to almost everything as too hot, too cold, too large, too small, too hard, or too soft. Take a minute right now to review the past 24 hours. During how many moments were you truly content, appreciating the moment-to-moment unfolding of your life? For most of us, these moments are the exceptions. They stand out in our memory. The rest of the time, we're restlessly pursuing some goal or another, trying with limited success to maximize pleasure and minimize pain or discomfort. This difficulty really being content is then amplified considerably by another accident of our evolutionary heritage. Too smart for our own good. As humans, we have other faculties besides the instinct to pursue pleasure and avoid pain that have helped us survive. It's a good thing, too. Magnificent as they are, our bodies are pathetic for life in the wild. No sharp claws, big teeth, or swift feet. Just imagine trying to frighten off a lion or tiger by baring your teeth and claws, or to escape from one by running away. Our hide also offers virtually no protection, and our fur is truly comical. A few tufts on top, under arms, and around sexual organs. Our eyesight and hearing aren't great compared to other creatures either, and our sense of smell is absolutely pitiful. Just ask a dog. What we do have, of course, is an extraordinary capacity to reason and plan. This ability enabled us to survive in the wild by thinking. Fred, Wilma, and our other ancestors figured out how to hunt animals and avoid being eaten themselves. They learned how to gather and cultivate plants. They developed the culture and technology that have enriched our lives and brought us to the point of dominating, and if we're not careful, destroying the planet. But here we find another adaptive mechanism, so well suited to our survival, that often makes us unhappy. Thinking and planning, wonderful and useful as they are at the heart of our daily emotional distress, because, unlike other tools, we can't seem to put these down when we don't need them. They keep us worrying about the future, regretting the past, comparing ourselves to one another in thousands of ways, and forever scheming about how to make things better. This makes it very difficult to be truly satisfied for more than a brief time. Our constant thinking can make it impossible to wholeheartedly enjoy a meal or listen to a concert, to fully listen to our child, or to fall back asleep in the middle of the night. It can send our emotions on a non-stop roller coaster as our mood soars and sinks based on thoughts. One day we're smart, attractive, popular, or successful. The next we're dumb, ugly, unwanted, or a failure. Even a casual observation of our minds reveals that we are compulsive thinkers. Thought stopping. I'd like you to try a little experiment right now. Close your eyes for about a minute and stop your thoughts. See if you can keep words from forming inside your head. What happened? Most people find that they can't stop thinking for more than a few seconds. Now jot down a few of the thoughts that came to mind. If you examine the content of your thoughts, you may notice that many of them are about the past or the future and involve wishes to increase pleasure and decrease pain. For example, I'm writing this right now on an airplane, which left very early in the morning. Before getting on the plane, I was deciding whether to get a granola and yogurt parfait. 400 calories. That's a lot. But what if I get hungry on the plane? Remember, they usually don't serve food anymore. Once on the plane, I wondered, should I nap or should I write? I'm pretty tired. Will I be exhausted later if I don't sleep? But maybe I'll feel better if I make some progress on the book. So far, this idea is winning. These are all perfectly reasonable thoughts. The problem is, when I close my eyes to rest for a few minutes, they don't stop. My mind keeps planning how to maximize pleasure and minimize pain, unless I'm lucky enough to fall asleep. We live most of our lives this way, lost in thought, more often thinking about life than experiencing it. But missing out on the moment-to-moment richness of life isn't our biggest problem. Unfortunately, our thoughts frequently make us unhappy. We are all susceptible to a kind of thinking disease. In our attempt to ensure that we'll feel good, we think of all the possible developments that might make us feel bad. While sometimes this is helpful, just as often it generates needless suffering, since every negative anticipatory thought is associated with a bit of tension or painful feeling. The number of at least mildly negative thoughts that arise in a day is extraordinary, even on good days. Negative thoughts inventory. Take a moment right now to review the thoughts that have passed through your mind so far today. Try jotting down all of the unpleasant, worried, or concerning ones that have arisen so far.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?